Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The third AMS program is Regional Food Systems Partnership. It's a pretty different one from the other two, and it supports public-private partnerships, coordination, convening, and planning for local and regional food systems, all with a goal to build and strengthen the viability and resilience of local and regional food economies.
On the Regional Food System Partnership, Tricia Kovacs with the Ag Marketing Service.
Projects might be public-private. They have to have these fund partnerships, as the name implies. So they have to have partners from two different categories, but the goal is to plan and develop those relationships with them and with producers and with food service operators, institutional markets, or others to really create the strongest network and foundation for markets for farmers in that region.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So every week for years, I come by here and I sound like an idiot economics professor when I walk through these things, trying to help our brothers and sisters here in this body who might be crazy enough or not have enough of a life to watch a presentation like this, to walk through the math. And it's a simple philosophy. At the end of the day, the math will always win.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert is the chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Council.
I'm going to try to do three things here. I'm going to try to actually get the reality of what happens, how the tax system works, when our brothers and sisters on the other side say, oh, you just raised taxes. That will cover everything. I'm going to show our history that it doesn't work that way. Second thing, I'm going to show a series of proposals we've made, and these are only my responsibility, so don't blame another member of Congress, of how we have this current reconciliation budget. We're going to have another one that sort of starts again this summer, because remember, we functionally have, depending on timing, you could have three bites of the apple on reconciliation. Why do we do reconciliation? It's a way to get through the filibuster in the Senate under the 1974 Budget Control Act. And I have brought pieces of legislation to reform Medicare Advantage, because you've seen the Wall Street Journal stories, the ProPublica stories of the almost, well, functioning, the criminality that's going on. The MedPAC report that basically shows hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of waste and fraud because of what some of the insurers are doing. I'm a big fan of a capitated healthcare delivery model because your incentive is to help people be healthier. But if you have a system where you can make stunning profits by scoring people as sicker, we got to misalign it. And that is not what Medicare Advantage was designed to do. It was designed to actually provide a package of delivery to make you healthier. I'm going to show a little bit of data on a talent-based immigration system. And over the previous weeks, I've come here before and shown we got a demographic crisis. We have a shortage of young people. Think about this bit of math. Take the last 20 years. 20 years ago and today, we functionally have the same number of 18-year-olds. But the number of people 65 and up has doubled. So over here, I have, what, my 1.8 million 18-year-olds. Over here, I've gone from 35 to now almost 70 million of our brothers and sisters who are 65 and up. You have a shortage of young people in this country. Unless you deal with that reality, but you don't want to open up the borders, that's the disaster. You make people poorer by bringing in people to compete with your working poor. And that's the cruelty of what the last administration did, is they crushed working people's wages. I want to grow the economy, grow productivity, make the society wealthier. And we're the only country in the entire industrialized world which hasn't moved to a talent-based immigration system so we can grow, we can compete. Look, slightly off the rhythm I wanted to use, 1970s, 80s, the world competed for hydrocarbons. Last decade, we competed for rare earths. This decade, and the economists say maybe the next two decades, the world's going to knife each other for smart people. In a world that basically is heading towards flat population growth, maybe we should show up to that battle, because we educate people here, we educate them with our system, then we send them home to compete with us. And we lost our mind, and to President Trump's credit, he's talked about this repeatedly.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Our topic this week is the current status of the cow-calf sector of the beef industry.
Dr. Mark Johnson is an Oklahoma State University beef breeding specialist and the host of Cow-Calf Corner on SUNUP.
The beef industry in the United States is really unique as compared to most countries. We've got a very large cattle finishing part of that, and the cow-calf sector itself, that segment that accounts for the production of the initial product, that calf that will eventually become beef, exists in a variety of production environments that get really extreme in terms of the temperature, the rainfall, the type of land that we use in one part of the country or another. Because of that, we always say there's not one perfect size or milk level production cow that fits all those production environments. But the cow-calf sector itself is a really critical component of using our ag resources, and particularly land that for the most part couldn't be used for crop production and just isn't really very well suited for anything other than the production of beef cattle, or particularly a cow that can take that grass and turn it into a calf. And so we've got a unique industry relative to other countries. Another unique part of that is that in this country we produce a really high quality beef product, and that there is a great demand among consumers for that high quality, consistently tasting beef product itself. If we take a look at inventories, we see that historically we're at a very low inventory of cows in production right now. And with really good consumer demand, what this leads to is record high value of all classes of cattle, as well as record high value of beef, the product. If we think of that typical cow-calf production system, the average size of it on a national basis is about 47 head. There's only about 10% of all cow-calf producers that operate on a really large scale, thinking over 50 head. And so again, some unique characteristics and dynamics of it. Currently, how do we supply the robust demand for beef with this really low cow inventory? We are finishing cattle to heavier weights than we ever have before. It's not unusual in the last couple years to hear about 15, 16, knocking the door of 1,700 pound pens of finished cattle coming out of the feed yard. So that extra tonnage equates to higher carcass weights and helps us meet the consumer demand. As we think about the future, this currently low inventory of cows, what it's doing for prices, we often ask the question, are we going to see an expansion in the cow-calf sector and bring numbers back up? That's going to depend on things like weather and drought. But as we think of, if we began to keep a really high percentage of replacement heifers this year, that biological time lag that I always talk about relative to beef production means that heifers born this spring turn into yearlings at 14 to 15 months of age that can be bred next spring, that turn into two-year-old pairs 2 years down the road. We are now 6 to 8 months out from weaning those calves potentially turning into yearlings, and they're going to be fed for 6 to 8 months once they go in the feed yard. So we've got several year runway before we actually begin to see increased cow numbers and increased amount of beef, the product. So where we're at looks like where we're going to be for a while because of that biological time lag.
You can learn more online at sunup.okstate.edu. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I rise today in recognition of this occasion of National Dairy Month and to honor the hardworking men and women of America's dairy industry, especially those in my home state of Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania Representative G.T. Thompson is chair of the House Ag Committee.
As a representative of Pennsylvania's 15th District and as a chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, I know firsthand the central role that dairy plays in our economy, our communities, and our health. Pennsylvania is an incredible dairy state with more than 6,200 dairy farms. We rank second in the nation in the number of dairy operations and eighth in milk production. These farms care for nearly 500,000 dairy cows and support more than 52,000 jobs, generating $14.7 billion annually for our state's economy. It's important that in addition to recognizing the success and strength of this industry, we also acknowledge the challenges it takes to produce the dairy products that we all know and love. rising costs, outdated federal regulations, and policies that don't reflect the realities on the ground have all hurt this vital industry. That's why we must continue to fight for a modernized farm bill and for smart bipartisan policies that promote health and strengthen rural communities. In addition, the One Big Beautiful Bill we passed out of the House included key victories for our dairy producers. The bill contains multiple enhancements to the dairy margin coverage program, such as increasing Tier 1 coverage eligibility from 5 million to 6 million pounds per farm, among other items. One of those bipartisan policies is the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act, which I proudly introduced alongside my colleague, Representative Kim Schreier, a pediatrician and a bipartisan coalition in both chambers of Congress. This bill is about returning to whole and reduced fat milk to school cafeterias. It reflects updated science, addressing years of flawed federal policy in response to what parents, schools, and health professionals across the country already know. Kids need access to milk that they'll actually drink. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has also voiced support for returning whole milk to school cafeterias. He recognizes its value as a nutrient-rich option that supports child development and academic success. Milk provides 13 essential nutrients, including calcium, vitamin D, and potassium. These nutrients support bone health, immune function, and long-term well-being. But today, nearly 3 in 4 school-aged children are not getting their recommended daily intake of dairy. Since whole milk was removed from schools in 2012, we've seen declines in milk consumption, increased food waste, and growing concerns about childhood nutrition. This legislation is a common sense solution that simply gives schools the option to serve whole and reduce fat milk once again. And I'm pleased to report that the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act has already made significant bipartisan progress. It has passed the House Committee on Education Workforce and most recently the Senate Agriculture Committee with strong support from both sides of the aisle. With over 300 votes in the House last Congress, this bill is ready to cross the finish line. Let me be clear, this is a win for everyone involved. It supports our children's health and gives a boost to our nation's dairy farmers who work hard every day to provide safe, nutritious products. Mr. Speaker, National Dairy Month is not just a moment of recognition. It's a call to action to stand with rural America, invest in the next generation, ensure our food policies are rooted in science and not bureaucracy. Let's finish the work we've started. Let's pass the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act. Let's deliver for our farmers, and let's keep making American agriculture stronger, healthier, and yes, great once again.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
CBO has us, over the next 10 years, adding another $22 trillion of debt.
Chairman of the Joint Economics Council for Congress, Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
If interest rates move now, because now you need to calculate the higher interest rates, if you start to put those dollars in, we're not completely there, but we're getting close to the next 10 years. We borrow as much as we did the previous 240 years. Okay, this has got to be the dozenth time I've set this on the floor, and I can't seem to get it to sink in, but that's the underlying math. And what should also be scaring people to death, yet the hallways are full of people coming into our offices demanding more money. The United States now is like number 12 or 13 on the credit stack. Meaning, take a look, Greece today can sell a 10-year bond cheaper than the United States. We have 18 states that can sell a 10-year bond cheaper than the federal government. But yet we borrow money to send to our states. Does this not just curl anyone's toes, but yet somehow magically we think the money tree is going to continue? Think of the protests, the whining. I won't use the word bedwetting because I think that's just inappropriate for a member of Congress to say. Baseline is the federal government intends to spend $86 trillion over the next 10 years. $86 trillion is the CBO baseline. All we're talking about in the budget reconciliation was a $2 trillion savings. 86 spend, $2 trillion. To give you an idea just how absurd this debate is, so tomorrow we're going to do, I think, a rescission vote. I think it's tomorrow, maybe it'll be Thursday. Think of the angst, the protest. We're upset. David, you can't lower spending. Okay, Let's see if we can do this. How many hours are there in a year? 8,700 hours in a year. Work with me on this, Mr. Speaker. 8,700 hours in a year. The rescission package takes care of 28 hours of that 8,700 hours of borrowing. Yet you listen to people come behind these microphones and it's like the world's coming to an end. Please understand, this is just the beginning. If you want this federal government to be able to stabilize and survive, when you have the economists on the left and the right saying, look, if we can get to about 3% of borrowing of GDP, we can stabilize. We're borrowing 7.3 this year. In 9 years, we're borrowing 9% of the entire economy. Understand what this means. That would be reduced spending this year. So we're going to spend, what, 7.3 trillion this year. You'd have to reduce federal spending by 1.4 trillion to get down to 3% borrowing. The vote we're going to have in the next day or so on the first part of the rescissions package covers 28 hours of borrowing for a whole year. And yet I know I even have members on my side who are all puckered up running around saying, oh, how do I explain that? Do you understand how much trouble we're in? If we're borrowing about $72,000 every second of every day, in 9 years, we're borrowing over $100,000 every second of every day. I've shown you before in the charts and the reports that the Democrats' plan of just raise taxes on everyone doesn't get you anywhere close to what's required. Remember, every tax hike they have, 1.5% of GDP, and we're borrowing over 7% this year. We need a revolution in how we deliver services. Yet, Mr. Speaker, I will tell you right now, you look at the lobbyists walking up and down our hallways, they despise, the bureaucracies despise anything that changes their business models.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So the U.S. Grains Council, we do not buy or sell commodities. Our currency, as we like to say, is information and relationships.
Ellen Zimmerman is the Director of Industry Relations with the U.S. Grains Council in Washington, D.C.
So our goal is to get U.S. Sellers in a room with buyers from around the world so that they can then have those conversations. The work that we do is, again, about bringing those people together, the relationship building pieces. And that's why the boots on the ground around the world are so important. They understand the market. They understand the players. They understand the trade dynamics. And, of course, you know, have relationships with those buyers, too, which is really key when we talk about trade servicing, too. The U.S. Grains Council wants to make sure we can answer questions of our buyers around the world about the good quality products that the U.S. has, understanding our pricing structure. What does our infrastructure look like? How does corn from Ohio get to somewhere else in the world? And our staff around the world are experts at answering those questions to help facilitate the trade. Again, relationship and information is our currency.
ROI is return on investment. It's a vital metric for the Grains Council.
At our buyer sellers conferences and other places where we have folks engaging, we do track sales made during those conferences or those programs. So Export Exchange, one of our big conferences, our flagship program in October 2024, resulted in 275 million sales in those 3 days of our conference there in Fort Worth, Texas. Similarly, when we have regional events, we do the same thing. We track those sales. We don't keep very respectful of the data of our customers. And so we're just asking them, did you make a sale? If so, how much? We don't get into the details of where exactly it's going, but we can certainly track those sales. We also track like market access or different things. So in a lot of our aquaculture programs, we're looking at inclusion rates. So higher inclusion rates means greater demand. The farm bill programs, MAP and FMD, have really good reporting structures. So we turn that into USDA so they know. And those programs have a 24-to-1 ROI on program successes. So what that looks like is, again, we turn those reports into USDA as well as the other cooperators that are working in that same space from those same program dollars. So we can show, of course, the government, but also our stakeholders that ROI too. So for ROI to our members, as they're funding the U.S. Grants Council for those first dollars, those stakeholder dollars, we're able to track the ROI for them too, which I think is really important. So our checkoff contributors in the state, our agribusiness, ethanol plant members, they can feel really confident that we're doing good work and kind of moving the needle on their behalf.
What's on the calendar?
Grand Rapids is going to be a really great conference to see some of the work that we have going on right now to celebrate 65 years of really rich history and look forward to the next chapter that's coming. The next big thing kind of on the docket for the Grains Council here in the U.S. is our Global Ethanol Summit. That's in October of 2025. We'll be bringing international ethanol policymakers and buyers from probably more than 40 countries. We're looking at attendance about 450 people here in DC to talk all about ethanol. What are the demand drivers? What are the potential uses? And what does policy look like for our customers around the world for them to be able to kind of build the policy, the infrastructure to be able to use ethanol moving forward? So those are the big ticket items left this year. And we'll be talking about 2026 in no time.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Milk Marketing Administrator recently took some time to review some of the things that we're seeing in dairy economics as well as on the feed side in our industry.
Dr. Mike Brook is Kansas State Dairy Specialist, reviewing some recent data from the Milk Marketing Administrator.
And I think historically it's important to review this data from time to time. As we look at milk prices over the last 10 years or so, we've seen a steady increase in milk price. There's a lot of volatility in that, but year over year, there is a general increase in the milk price that you're receiving for your raw milk. Some years may be down a little bit on average and other years up. The other thing that they did a nice job of reviewing is some changes in our feed prices, taking a look at things like soybean meal and corn prices over those same years, and realizing that, again, there's ups and downs. And in general, the prices for things like soybeans and corn have increased over that same time period. However, as we look at the near term, what's been going on here in the last couple of years, we've actually got a little bit of relief of the price of feeds. And one of the bright spots for us in the dairy industry right now is the value of our slaughter cows. And as we look at that, there's been slight increases over that past 10-year period. But here recently, in the last couple, 3 years, we've seen some very significant increases in the cull market. And many of you are experiencing some very nice gains when we look at the price of those excess bull calves and crossbreed animals that you're selling off the dairy farm. As we move forward, though, one of the things that I always keep track of is what's going on with the milk-to-feed price ratios as we look across the United States. You know, if we look at 21, 22, and 23, we really struggled with margin in our dairy industry, looking at the price of milk versus the price of our feeds that we're feeding. 2024 was actually a bright spot. We saw a steady increase in that ratio throughout most of the year and a little bit of decrease as we hit November and December. So as we come into 2025, we continue to see that decrease, that the milk-to-feed price ratios have continued to decrease each month. And we would expect, even though we're seeing lower feed prices, we're also seeing lower prices for our raw milk that we export from the farms. So we would expect that those ratios will continue to decrease. And likely for 2025, the way it's looking right now, we actually might see a less than average milk-to-feed price ratio in 2025 than we did in 2024. So many of those gains that we saw in 2024 are quickly being erased by changes that we see going on currently. And again, most of that is due to the more recent decrease in milk price that we're seeing on our dairy farms. So as we look forward into the finishing up 2025 and moving on into 2026, I would expect that we're going to continue to see tight margins. That's going to be buffered, I think, a little bit by the prices that we're receiving for coal cows, as well as the prices that we're receiving for those crossbred calves, as well as straightbred bull calves that we're selling off the farm. So that's helping us make up some of those differences, but they're not going to totally make up for the entire decrease that we're seeing in that margin.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
In a year that signifies the 20th anniversary of the nation's renewable fuel standard, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin acknowledged to farm broadcasters last month in a visit to USDA that focus was centered
towards making a decision on the path forward on RVOs, but that's a decision to be made imminently.
And that decision about proposed renewable volume obligations associated with producing renewable fuels in both 2026 and 2027 was announced Friday by EPA. Proposed volumes are over 24 billion gallons for next year and a slightly higher proposed total the following year. Both would be the highest RVOs when finalized. In a press release, Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins commended the decision for bringing certainty to the biofuel industry, contributing to lower fuel prices and increasing biofuel production for export opportunities. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.